Good morning. This edition of the Sports Inquirer podcast is brought to you by thesportsinquirer.net. As always, the premier site for news and notes in the world of sports. And there'll be some content up this weekend as relation to, or actually it'll be later next week or early next week, more NFL analysis, reactions to the latest UFC on Fox event, and all other things related to sports. And also, as always, go to my Twitter account, Sports Inquirer, all one word, for some updates as well. And if you want to send an email to myself or to the program itself, send the email to sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Also brought to you by thestartinglineup.net, an excellent internet radio show based out of Chicago. I was up Chicago last week and recorded a show with them. Really good group of people there. So just give them some love as well in your sports researching world. All right, let's get the show started. All right, everybody. Welcome to the Sports Inquirer podcast. It's E. Marcel Pertut. Been a while since I did the show. I actually had some work issues come up. Well, not work issues, but things coming up in my professional life that got nothing major as far as emergency-wise. But, you know, things get in the way. And then also, I was in Chicago last week at this time. And I'll delve into my Chicago trip, I think, throughout my analysis. Really good experience up there. Great city. Thank you to my cousin Lisa for setting up a lot of things for me. Had some good business meetings as well. So Chicago was treating me very well. And we'll just start with, actually, while I was up there, I was able to go to a Bulls game. I saw the Chicago-Detroit contest. Unfortunately, Derrick Rose was not in the game. Obviously, if you're listening to the show, you know if the latest knee injury that has him out for the year. Or if you listen to him himself, Rose is saying he may come back towards the end of the season. Interesting being up there as an outsider living here in Atlanta. We kind of see the Derrick Rose drama as maybe a distraction or a deterrent from the Bulls. It's being in a difficult situation as far as the team goes because he's a native son there. From born and raised in Chicago, I thought that it'd be a town that really supported him through thick and thin and would really not necessarily be a hostage to his health, but realizing that the fate of their franchise really lies with him. But when I went up there, I noticed two things. One, in talking to the locals, the fans of Chicago that live there and fans of Bulls for most of their lives, one, it seems like they realized that, I think the last year distractions when he was constantly saying that between the Bulls and Rose, one time he shut out for, he's done for the year. Then you see him warming up before the first round playoff series last season against the Nets and him looking good on the court and people saying that he looks better than ever. He's ready to come back. And then the game would start and you would see him on the sideline in a suit and tie. I think Bulls fans are kind of disillusioned with it and are kind of over the drama, which I thought that it was a Rose town and that they would want him to come back. And I think that, and obviously you want Rose at full strength because when he's at his maximum skill level, he's one of the five best players in the NBA. But I think that the team is and the fans seem to have moved on from him. Even when I was at the arena, when they had a lot of the pregame video content, Rose was in some of it, but a lot of it would end with Joakim Noah. And that's my second point. Noah seems to be the star of the Bulls, at least the people's champion or the fans' champion when it comes to Chicago. personally, I've been on Noah's bandwagon since he was at Florida. I love his aggressiveness, the way he plays, efficient on both sides of the ball, especially with the defensive side and rebounding. I love that stuff. But it's really become his town. He got the loudest cheers. You saw the most Rose jerseys, which is understandable. But Noah was right there. He ended a lot of the video segments. I said the fans seemed to even be most excited about him. And I found that quite interesting. But despite all of the issues that the Bulls are having, and they actually lost that game to Detroit behind a really strong effort from Brandon Jennings. And Detroit's an interesting team as well. And I was glad I got Detroit as far as seeing the opposing team. Similar to Noah, I've been a fan or a big follower of Andre Drummond ever since he was at Connecticut. And while he didn't put together a 20-point, 15-rebound performance, I liked what I saw from him. Ran the floor very well, got a few offensive rebounds, really good body positioning for a young big man. You have to realize the guy is younger than, I think he's about 22 or 23. Really good skills for him. I like what I saw from Brandon Jennings, still shoots the ball way too much. He got hot, especially in the third and early in the fourth quarter. But I think that's going to really limit their offense when they get later on in the season, especially if they get to the postseason, which they will be. Josh Smith, as an Atlanta native, seeing him up close for a few years, really has controlled his game in Detroit. The problem was when he was in Atlanta, he should have been more inside. That's the role they needed him to be in. And he would still shoot the outside jumpers, try to ball handle all the time, and act like he was a point guard. In Detroit, just the way their offense is structured, he has to make more perimeter shots. He's taking more, and he's still not shooting at a high percentage, but I'm understanding what his role is with that team, and he seems to be executing that a little bit better in Detroit than he was in Atlanta. Greg Monroe seems to be lost in the offense, though, and that's where, if you follow the trade rumors like I do, and a lot of you do, that's when you see him up close, you realize he's kind of the odd person out in that offense. Obviously, Brandon Jennings has the ball in his hands most of the time as far as point guards go. So he has control. Drummond, he works inside. Post moves aren't necessarily there completely, but you know, a lot of putbacks, rebounds. So he kind of flows in the offense. And then Josh Smith is in the outside. Monroe, I think they should play him more at the high post and use his passing ability a little more often. But when you have Drummond kind of clogging up the lane and Smith, who is a big small forward who struggles shooting, Monroe seems to be the odd person now. So we'll see how that works out. But despite all of the struggles of the Bulls and the Pistons to a lesser extent, they're still going to make the playoffs because the Eastern Conference is borderline terrible. And it's a sad state of it. The Eastern Conference has some strong marquee franchises that have hosted some of the best players and teams in history. You're looking at the Celtics, the 76ers, the Knicks to a lesser extent, the Pistons, they've had some championship caliber and Hall of Fame players. You look at the Eastern Conference, and there were some marquee franchises with great players, and between trades, free agency, ineptitude at the front offices, the Eastern Conference has really struggled, and as of right now, as we record the podcast, there's still only two teams above 500 in the conference, and that's Miami and Indiana, who are clearly going to be in the Eastern Conference Finals outside of some major injury or just a complete collapse from either squad. Speaking of Miami and Indiana, those are clearly the two best teams. They played earlier this week. And the game went kind of how I expected it to go. Miami came out very strong. Paul George was negated by LeBron James in the first half. Dwayne Wade, he played, had a really strong effort. Miami held a double-digit lead at halftime. However, if you've been watching the Pacers for most of the season, you know that their defense ratchets up in the second half. Paul George, the NBA's leading scorer in the third quarter, he started going. DeSean Stevenson started getting some moments. Even Roy Hibbert, he continued his defensive prowess. David West, who becomes kind of a forgotten man, in that entire Pacers starting lineup. We've talked about Paul George and his elevation to maybe an All-NBA MVP caliber candidate. We talked about that in the last podcast. Deshaun Stevenson, we've discussed his improved maturity as a player. David West is really the player that gets lost in the shuffle. He's an efficient post player, power forward, can give you a double-double, really a tough, sturdy man down inside. I thought he really shined in that contest as well against Miami. The Pacers, and we've been saying this throughout the regular season, have the three things that can beat Miami. One, they have solid guard play. The teams that give Miami the most trouble as far as on the defensive end when the Heat are playing on that side are solid guard play, especially at point guard. So you have that going for you with the good play of Hill and Stevenson as far as the backcourt. Number two, you're not going to stop LeBron James. He's still, and we're going to get to James in a minute. He's still the best player in the NBA. He's still going to get his moments and get his points and fill up the stat sheet. But if you can slow him down in some way, that's extremely important. Perimeter defensive-wise, they have George, who's become an excellent two-way player, can at least negate James or slow him down. And then if James goes aside, he has to deal with Hibbert and with West. And even Stevenson can get some moments as far as guarding James, so you can slow him down and get him, wear him down. And then thirdly, Indiana has the advantage of inside presence. We talked about West, Roy Hibbert, who's really running away with the defensive MVP award, at least at the quarter mark of the regular season. He brings a presence that Miami cannot deal with. Chris Bosh really struggles with physical inside players. Chris Anderson, really good energy guy, but not someone that can consistently be relied on as far as giving inside presence, especially on the scoring end. So Indiana fills all of that criteria of teams that can beat the Miami Heat. Now, I picked the Bulls to win the Eastern Conference and to win the NBA Finals, so obviously that's not going to happen at this stage of the game, but really good contest between those two, with the Pacers emerging with the win at home. For all the talk of, I sound like Paul George's agent as much as I mentioned his name, and Chris Paul getting some love as far as being a top flight player, Kevin Durant is still the second best player in the NBA. Got to watch some of the contest of the Thunder. They came to Atlanta this past week. And it's strange to be at the stage of his career where he's underappreciated. I'm not going to say he's underrated, because I think people regard him as a MVP caliber player. He's taken the team to the finals once in his career. But we kind of ho-hum Kevin Durant for averaging, you know, 26 points, giving you 6-7 rebounds, shooting close to 50% from the field, 40% from three-pointers, excellent free-throw shooter, maybe the most devastating offensive player in the NBA considering his close to 7 feet height and the length that he has. Tough matchup for any forward to deal with. We kind of just take him for granted. Maybe it's because we like the flavor of the month and we've elevated James as the best player in the NBA, which he is, and we're content with that, and that's just the status that no one's going to be able to reach for the time being. And we want to talk about George and Chris Paul and maybe a handful of other players. Tony Parker, you know, will get some love, and I've heard even Kevin Love talk. You know, we just like to maybe elevate someone new, but we need to appreciate Durant and what he brings to the table. And just watching him against the Hawks, how efficient he is in his offense. He doesn't rush shots. He takes, you know, he'll go to the right spots when needed. He gets open and puts together a 30-point performance. So I think that just watching him was very impressive, and seeing him perform. The Western Conference, though, has been very exciting between Golden State, the Clippers, San Antonio, I think, is still the best team in the conference at, you know, right now. I picked Houston to make the NBA Finals, and I'm very leery of that after watching the Portland-Houston game last night. I'm glad that I got to see Portland. I have the NBA I have an NBA channel at home, so I've seen Portland a little bit, but I like having the TNT content, because personally I don't have the NBA package. Finances just aren't there for me to have it, but I was glad when I saw the schedule and the Blazers were on it, so I got to watch that game up close quite a bit. The Blazers aren't they're not a contender for the championship, and I don't know if they're even a contender to make the Western Conference Finals, because I still think that's going to be San Antonio and Oklahoma City when it's all said and done. But I like what Portland has done, because they're a franchise that could have really tanked it and really laid down on two occasions within the past 5 years. One, the Greg Oden debacle gives them not much, really gives them nothing. When you consider he was the number one overall pick, a center that they wanted to build around, he has his leg injuries, is now in Miami. They could have really folded after that went down. Then Brandon Roy, who people forget about, but was in the discussion as maybe one of the best guards in the NBA. Multiple-time All-Star, averaged more than 20 points, really good rebounder, solid defender for his position. And he had knee issues, and he's out of the NBA right now. So those were two situations where a lot of franchises would still be trying to recover from, and both of those happened within 5 years. Portland, to their credit, kept LaMarcus Aldridge, when in the beginning part of his career, he was a source of a lot of trade rumors, but they kept him around, and he's developed into an all-star power forward. I was really impressed with his game. Tall player. He's not Dirk Nowitzki and Kevin Durant as far as outside shooting range. He's not a three-point shooter, but 20 feet in, that guy is outstanding. Long arms, the shot doesn't get blocked. I was surprised by how many jumpers he was able to make. You look at his size, he looks like he's a legit 7 feet tall and should be inside, but shoots a lot of jumpers, makes a majority of them. I was very impressed with his stroke. Damian Lillard, very aggressive. I like, similar to the Russell Westbrook argument where people don't like his aggressiveness and think he deters from the Thunder's offense. Personally, I like the aggressiveness. He does get out of control sometimes, but that's what's going to happen when you have a player that plays at a high aggressive level. Lillard kind of has that same vibe. Not necessarily the best point guard as far as passing goes, but he passes enough. Really, he gets inside, really tough player, and still gets 20 a game. So that he, for that offense that Portland's trying to run, it works really well. Nicholas Batum, excellent third option for them. Wesley Matthews, when they signed him, I didn't like it. I thought it was for too much money. But he has been a strong outside shooter for Portland. Good team overall. And then you can't forget Robin Lopez, who should be on Phoenix and on several other teams. He seems to bounce around the league for such an efficient big man. He's not going to give you Dwight Howard, Roy Hibbert production, but for that, once again, for that offense that runs through Lillard and through Aldridge, really strong performer for them. So I like their team as far as maybe being a semifinalist in the Western Conference. So I like what I saw in Portland. As far as Houston goes, very disappointed in the Rockets. Howard had a good first half. Nice post moves, used the left hand efficiently, even made some bank shots. I like that he ran the floor aggressively, got in some good post positions, and they broke it down very well on TNT. As far as in the past, earlier in the season, him not being aggressive and demanding the ball, I thought he did a really good job in the first half of that. Second half, not as much. I thought Harden may have held the ball a little too often. And it seemed like their offense just did not flow completely in that second half. They still put up more than 100 points, but Portland ended up scoring 111. And defensively, that's where Houston gets in so much trouble. Howard is a solid defender inside, but the rest of the team is below average defensively, especially in the guard positions. And that's where you're going to run into a lot of trouble against an efficient offense like Portland. And that's what you saw up close and personal in that contest. So Houston has some work to do. They're still going to be a solid contender in the Western Conference, but they have some things they need to work on before they can make that next step to the next level. All right, we're going to take a break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into the NFL and the drama that's going on in our nation's capital here on the Sports Inquirer podcast. All right, welcome back to the podcast. Host E. Marcel Portu. Let's delve into the NFL. Once again, I was in Chicago this past week and did not get to see the Bears game. And we're going to get into Chicago weather in a bit. It was cold. I don't think it reached past 25 degrees the whole time I was there during the day or at night. And it's a cold area, but I actually kind of liked it. It eliminates the BS of life, man. And so we're going to get to the cold weather and what's ruffling my feathers. But while I was up there, similar to the Derrick Rose situation as far as getting the vibe of the city with a player who's been injured, I wanted to get the vibe of what they think of Jay Cutler. And I'll admit, if you're listening to this show, you know that I went to Vanderbilt. And I could be a Jay Cutler apologist a little bit to the fault. I try not to have biases in sports when I look at them. Like, I'm a Giants fan. If they're terrible, I'll tell you. The Knicks have been an embarrassment so far this season in the NBA. And I grew up a Knicks fan. So I'll tell you, I'll keep it real, and I'll be honest with you. If my teams aren't doing well, or if a player that I follow, he's struggling. But with Jay Cutler, maybe because he brought some relevance to a program that really struggled and made him respectable in his own way. When I look at Cutler, I'd maybe look at it with Vanderbilt-colored glasses. But I still think that he could be a viable player in the NFL. But I think his time in Chicago is going to be done. And it's funny because when I was outlining the podcast, we were supposed to try to record this on Wednesday, but things came up, but we're talking to you here on Friday morning. Mark Trestman, the head coach of the Bears, did not confirm if Cutler was going to play. And I have on my outline that I'm reading to you right now, Jay Cutler has taken his last snap with the Chicago Bears. And sure enough, last night or yesterday, it was announced that Cutler was going to play this week against Cleveland. The vibe, first of all, let's get to the vibe of the city with Cutler. It seems like people have kind of been ready, in Chicago, are ready to move on from him. I still think there's some residual negative reviews or effects of that NFC Championship game, I believe back in 2011, when Cutler sprained his knee or had a tear of one of the ligaments and did not come back to play the game. And the Packers won the NFC Championship game in Chicago and eventually won the Super Bowl. And they saw Cutler just standing on the sidelines, not moving around and wanting him to get back in the game. So I think there's still residual effect of the fans thinking that he's soft and that he's weak. But if he was soft and weak, I think by now we would have had a teammate come out and maybe through directly or maybe anonymously talk about his lack of toughness or effort as a player. All of the Bears and his teammates seem to defend him vehemently. Brandon Marshall, we've heard numerous times defend Cutler. Offensive linemen, who are obviously the most cynical and most critical of their quarterback, they've defended him. Now, they may be playing the public game of being nice and not wanting to be negative towards their quarterback to the media and to the public, but I really believe that they like Cutler. He just gets hurt. And I thought it would be his last time playing for Chicago for several reasons. One, they've had Josh McCown there, and he's been putting in work. He's been throwing for multiple 300-yard plus games and had, I think, four touchdowns passing against Dallas last Monday night. He had a rushing touchdown as well. I believe that if you have a quarterback in there that's understanding the offense, is flowing well with your receivers and the offensive line, and everything's clicking, you stick with that, especially at this juncture of the season when you're trying to make the postseason and they have a very good chance of winning that division, especially with the struggles of Detroit and of Green Bay. So that's when I said it was going to be his last down or last snap taken with the Bears. I thought that Trestman would stick with McCown and ride it out these last three games. But it looks like he's going to go back to Cutler. And then another reason I thought it would be his last time playing with Chicago is the finances. Cutler is going to be due for an extension at the end of the year, a multi-year, large financial commitment. And when you see McCown playing, I don't think McCown is necessarily the future either. He's an older player. He's been a career backup. He's having a really good ride right now. And good for him. He's making some money for him in this offseason as well, whether with the Bears or somewhere else. But I think that when you look at the financial commitment that they're going to have to make to Cutler, it's not worth it for the Bears. I think with Trestman there, a good offensive mind, and the weapons they have, I don't think you find anybody to go in there and do well. But I don't necessarily think they need Cutler to succeed. And that's where I thought that they would actually look at it from that perspective and say, well, we could plug in anybody right now, and we'll deal in the offseason as far as if Cutler's coming back or not, but we're going to stick with McCown and keep it moving. But then there was in the last point on Cutler and the Bears and the way things are going. For a franchise like Chicago, who's been around forever, pretty much since the inception of the league itself, you look at the lack of quality quarterbacks they've had in the city over time. And I'm not going to go back to the 40s and 50s and 60s. Or they've had some Hall of Famers and quality players, of course. But really since the 70s, who's been a quality quarterback for the Bears? And you Chicago fans out there probably name the list of all of the guys. It's been like a turnstile with all the quarterbacks that have been there. Outside of Jim McMahon, who had a few solid years in the 80s. And obviously won a championship with Chicago. The Bears in the quarterback position have been terrible. It's been a really bad group. And you finally have a guy in Cutler who, I don't know if he's a championship quarterback, but is a quality franchise guy. And it's tough to just turn your back on him and say, okay, we're done with him. We'll find the next one. I think that's where some of the fans have the impression of is like, you've not been here for the past 20 years and seen the really low quality QBs we've had under center for this team. So that's where you see the fans liking Cutler and says, hey, this is the best we've ever had. But I still think that they can go another direction and maybe do better than Cutler. Moving on to other things in the NFL, I love seeing the snow on all the games on Sunday. I said, being a Northeasterner, grew up in New York City, being used to seeing football in snow, I love just the visuals of that. The Philadelphia-Detroit game in Philly, that was crazy with all the snow. You know, I think they said it snowed about 5 or 6 inches during the contest. You could barely see the fog. And that's where you have another example, too. And this is why Detroit, for all of the talent they have, will never elevate themselves to a championship-level team. Here you have a snowstorm going on. And I know Reggie Bush, he got inactivated during warm-ups. I think he had re-aggravated a calf injury or a lower leg injury. You're not going to be able to throw the ball 40 to 45 times like you normally do. I know you have Calvin Johnson out there, best receiver in the NFL, and Matthew Stafford is a solid quarterback himself. Run the ball. Stop trying to run slants and deep routes. Change the game plan. And while Philadelphia was fortunate as far as their offense, they run the ball a lot anyway between McCoy and Chip Kelly's zone read offense. It just caters to that. they were smart enough not to let Foles, who's had an outstanding run for the Eagles, throwing the ball down the field a lot. Run the ball, keep it smart, keep it simple, and keep it moving. And that's where you saw Detroit running all of these pass routes in the middle of the snow. And guys can't run proper routes in that. And that's why they lost the game and blew the lead in the second half. And of course, there was the fun game in Baltimore. They ended up getting the win late against Minnesota with some punt, especially the Jones return for the kick return for the touchdown. That was an outstanding contest. And I said, I just like seeing snow out there. Football is meant to be played in colder elements. I know here in the Southeast, you're used to playing in the hot weather and things like that, but it still should be a game with some bite to it, with some frost involved. And speaking of Philadelphia, I did not see the Nick Foles era coming to this. I knew that Foles would get some time this year because Vic is in the last year of his contract, and he's clearly not in the future plans of the Eagles. And obviously when you have a new regime come in with Chip Kelly and then a guy from the old regime in Michael Vick, that's obvious. That's usually a clash, and the new regime is going to win most of the times in that regard and play the new player. But Foles has been a nice revelation for them. I think he could be a Pro Bowl quarterback with that offense, and he has weapons that obviously help him out, but every good quarterback has weapons that makes them look better. But I like Nick Foles and what I'm seeing from there, seeing what the Eagles are going to do. They're going to win that division. They're going to get a home game, and they're going to be a tough home team against probably Carolina, and it'll probably, or maybe St. Arabia, Carolina, or New Orleans, or San Francisco, just looking at the NFC wild card. That road team is maybe going to be the favorite, but don't sleep on the Eagles of winning that first round wild card game at home, being the division champion. I like San Francisco reverting back to their old school, old style offense in their win over Seattle. I think they were tempted with Colin Kaepernick and making him a big time passer. And he has an incredibly strong arm and chuck the ball all around the field. And in that first game of the season against the Packers, you saw him throw, I think 400 yards, rush for close to 100, just put up video game numbers. And once the 49ers saw that, they were enamored to have Kaepernick do that every single game. And it caught up with them. They lost to Indianapolis at home. Had some disappointing losses during the season. Relatively disappointing losses. But I think they really, and you saw it in there, and it started with that Thursday night game on the road at St. Louis, where they realize we're a running team. We have Frank Gore. We have a stable of backs. Our receiving options aren't really the best as far as catching ability. Let's run the ball, use some play action, use some read option, and go about it that route. And ever since then, their offense has improved. It's not as glamorous and flashy as that first game against Green Bay, but it's going to be more effective for them overall. I still think the Seahawks are a better team, and Seattle's going to win the West and probably get home field advantage. And heading up there to win a game is going to be very difficult for any team. But if San Francisco can get their solid defensive play and run the ball behind Gore and Dixon and a few other their running backs, they're going to put themselves in a better position to be a title contender. Gary Kubiak had to go in Houston. I don't think necessarily entirely his fault that Houston's lost 11 games in a row heading into this Sunday's contest. But when you lose 11 in a row and that last game is on national TV on the road to lowly Jacksonville, it's time to move on as far as the franchise goes. I think what happened with that situation is Kubiak wasn't going to come back. He's had some decent, and if you have to look at the backstory of it, he gets to Houston, they finish 8-8 for 2 years in a row, don't make the postseason, and it's like, okay, we need to make that next step or you're fired. They make that next step, win the division the last 2 years, win that first round home game against the Bengals last 2 seasons, and then lose the next game that once was to New England and that once was to Baltimore. So they've kind of reached this level of, okay, we've made the playoffs, we won the first round game, we're going to make the Super Bowl the next round. That has to be the next logical step. But then Schaub gets injured once again. They have Case Keenum in there as quarterback, who I think has done an okay job despite the losses. You lose Brian Cushing on the offense, on the defensive side of the ball, and it just falls apart from there. So you knew he wasn't going to come back. He had the stroke during the Sunday night game, the game against Indianapolis, I believe. So obviously, and I know he came back, and that's why I'm concerned about John Fox, too, over in Denver. Coaching's very important. We love this game, NFL. It's exciting. We follow it. We're interested in it. It's not worth losing your life over. And that's when I see guys like John Fox and Kubiak. These aren't things where it's like, okay, you know, they had a little headache and they didn't feel well, had the flu. Fox had a heart attack. Kubiak had a stroke. And both of these guys are coming back on the sidelines less than 2 months after that happens in a highly stressful position. Very concerned about both of their guys' health. And I know they've been checked out and medically cleared and everything. But I think Houston realized, like, look, you're not going to come back. You're going to get your money. He's going to get paid. Take these last few games off. Get your health right. And then look for other positions in the NFL. So I think that was a negotiation that they're not going to go public with. But that's what really happened. And if Houston did that, I can understand that. That was a really good move by them to let him go. Let him rest up. Get his health right and move on. Gronkowski may have cost the Patriots Super Bowl appearance. While I still think Denver and Kansas City may still be better than New England, having Gronkowski involved was a major boost for the Patriots' offense. For all of the Amendola and the smallish receivers that New England has and the greatness of Tom Brady that we see every week, they still needed a vertical threat to take that offense to another level. And Rob Gronkowski came back and was performing at a high level the past few weeks. Of course, he has injury issues as well. Tears his ACL. He's out for the rest of the year. And I'm not going to say he has taken his last snap with the Patriots, because for all of the goofiness and the knucklehead antics he has off the field, on the field he's a performer. And he's their best offensive weapon for Tom Brady. So they're going to keep him around. But you have to be really concerned about him long term as a player that you can trust to be an efficient offensive performer for you. And then finally, the drama in Washington. We could spend a whole podcast on what's going on with the Redskins. Personally, Mike Shanahan's going to need to brush up his resume because he's going to be done with the Redskins. I kind of respect the hustle. And let me tell you why I respect the hustle. And I learned this personally over in a past position in employment. One rule in life for all of you younger guys, men and women out there listening to the show, especially for someone that's been in the workforce for close to 10 years now, you never quit a job. You get fired. Several reasons for that. One, as much as your job right now is, you may be unhappy with it and think you should be doing better, making more, I think most of us, at some level, if you have aspirations to do well professionally, you're always going to look to, you know, look for something to a different level. You know, maybe you're content, you're happy in your position that you're at now, but you know, you're looking towards the future and you say, hey, I should be making this amount. I should be, you know, performing these tasks and responsibilities. Slow your roll on that, because if you just quit and up and leave, that next job is not guaranteed for you. Now, if you find something else out there that maybe fits your personality better or fits your career goals better, definitely pursue that and leave your old job respectfully, give them notice and do what you have to do and be professional about it. But if you don't have that new position, do not leave. And then secondly, you want compensation for it. Now, obviously, NFL and professional sports with contracts are a little bit different. Some of you may have contracts in your jobs, and you're seeing a little bit more of that lately. But if you quit, you don't get compensation for the contract that says you should receive X amount of money. If you get fired, you are owed that money. And that's where you're seeing Mike Shanahan realizing, I'm on contract to make $7 million a year. If I quit, I may not get my money. And he's dealt with that before when he was with the Oakland Raiders, or the Los Angeles Raiders at that time. And he got fired by Al Davis after spending 1 year as head coach. And he's had to go to court to fight for his money. And that's why he's still bitter towards the Oakland franchise and towards Al Davis when for all these years. He realized he got burned in the past not getting his money. So you definitely know he's not just going to up and leave the job he has now just to be nice or pursue other options. He's a Hall of Fame caliber coach. He's going to have his options out there. Now, what I kind of don't understand is the whole sitting down Robert Griffin the third deal for the past for the next three games. We all know that Griffin is not right. If you watched him play at Baylor and in the first half of last season when he was healthy, you can see him right now that his footwork has been bad. He still has a big knee brace on him, which is very telling to me, where you wore that big knee brace in that playoff game against Seattle before you tore your ACL and he hurt his knee. And then he came back this year, didn't have necessarily as big of a brace. And throughout the year, now he has that big brace back on his leg. To me, that says he's not completely right as far as his health goes. So if you want to go with the angles, like, okay, he's our franchise guy, we're going to rest him, we don't want him to get hurt more, I guess, kind of understand that. But you also have to look at the entire flow of what's been going on with that team, especially in the offensive end. And I'll give Brian Baldinger credit. I always try to give credit to things I see on television, and I have my own analysis, but if someone beats me to it or gives me a different view of something, you gotta give him credit. So I was watching, I think, AFC Notebook or Playbook on the NFL Network, and Baldinger broke down the entire offensive line of the Redskins when they played at home against the Giants on Sunday Night Football. And their lack of skill, as far as that's a game that Justin Tuck had four sacks in the game, or had 3.5 to 4 sacks. The offensive line let guys take free shots at Griffin and just run right at him. The blocking scheme was bad. He took a lot of unnecessary hits. So the offensive line has been playing below average the whole season. So it's not all on Griffin that they've struggled. But if I were the Redskins, I would not give Cousins a chance. I wouldn't have just said that he's out for the entire year and we're going to put him on IR. What does that say to the teammates and the franchise? Yes, they're not going to make the playoffs. They're going to finish pretty low. They don't have their first round draft pick. The Rams actually do. So they can't even go into tank mode, which is very popular discussion in the NBA as far as trying to finish with the worst record to give yourself a higher draft slot. The Rams actually have that pick from the RG3 trade from last year to acquire him. So I don't know if I were Washington and I was Daniel Snyder, the owner, or even Mike Shanahan, I would sit down Griffin because he's not performed at the level that he should be. And you could, and maybe because of injury, maybe lack of training, whatever reason, he has not performed at the high level that we've seen him at. So I would sit him, but I wouldn't just rule him out for the entire year. I thought that was just he's a football player. You can't really shield him or protect him like that. If he's going to perform hopefully at a Super Bowl level that you want him to be in, he's going to put himself in tough positions. And the angle also, and I'll end my NFL notes on this, as far as trying to auction off Kirk Cousins and giving him a shot, as far as auditioning him for future trades for this offseason, you kind of would be better off if you sat him the rest of the year, if that's the angle that they're going with. If he plays less, the allure and the mystery is there. Now, if he plays well for these next three games, maybe you raise the trade value of him and say this could be a franchise guy. But then it can also backfire too, where he's always been lurking behind Robert Griffin this entire, because they're drafted in the same draft, first rounder for RG3, third rounder for Cousins. He's always been lurking in the background as being a potential starter. If he tears it up, or if he does well these last three games, then you have an unnecessary quarterback controversy. And then you'll definitely have to trade Cousins, because Robert Griffin III, whether it's the Snyder, the ownership, and the fans, they want him out there. So you're just creating more drama than you need and more unnecessary stuff. So those are my NFL thoughts. We're going to take another break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve a little bit into college football here on the podcast. All right, welcome back to the podcast. E. Marcel Portut back with you. As always, if you want to contact us, go to Sports Inquirer on Twitter, all one word. Also send us an email at sportsinquirer@gmail.com. And always go to thesportsinquirer.net, and that's where you can find all of my updates and anything that you'll need in relation to the site. We're going to delve more into the college football bowls next week and do some more breakdowns as far as what's been going on in that side of things. But when I was looking at the bowl selection show, seeing where Central Florida was going to be and Vanderbilt, Georgia Tech, and a few other teams that I follow for personal and professional reasons, it dawned on me that we have too many bowls. And I know if you're listening to this show, you know that you're a fan of college football, or you at least acknowledge it or follow it. When I was younger, growing up in an area that wasn't strong in college football in the Northeast, I looked forward to bowl season because it was a chance for me to see teams that I were not used to viewing. Whether it was some Big Ten teams, a lot of Southeastern Conference teams, I would look forward to a bowl game that included Washington and maybe Texas, because I did not see them during the regular season quite, you know, too much. So I wanted to see what was going on with that. Or hey, I hear that Michigan's a bad example, but you know, hey, I hear Arizona has a really good defense. Let's see them play in this bowl game. So I used to like watching. My personal favorite was the Carquest Bowl. I love that there was a bowl game named after a rental center. I always loved that. You could rent a car and watch a game. So that was my favorite bowl name. And there have been some Blue Bonnet Bowls, and we've got the Poinsettia Bowl now, named after a flower. Yeah, we've got some funky, or the Potato Bowl. I love that stuff. Like, we'll have to break down my favorite bowl names of all time, probably the next episode. And remind me of that if you're on Twitter or see me in the streets. To remind me to have my favorite bowl names of all time. But it used to be that you would have a handful of games before New Year's Day, and then New Year's Day was appointment TV. And that's where I had off from school. I'd get the chips. I'd maybe get a pizza, make a nice sandwich. And from 11 a.m. all the way to midnight, there were games all day. You'd start off with maybe the Gator Bowl or, you know, things like that. Maybe the Hall of Fame, things like that. You would start with those. And then you'd get towards the heavyweights. That's when you would have the Rose Bowl, probably around 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, 3, 4 o'clock. That game would get tipped off, watching Big Ten versus Pac-10 and watching that game. Then the Fiesta Bowl would kind of delve into that a little bit. So you'd have those two games going on. And once the Rose Bowl ended and the Fiesta was kind of winding down, that's when you had the Orange Bowl in Miami and the Sugar Bowl in New Orleans going head-to-head against each other. That concept for your younger fans is incomprehensible. It's like, how can you have the Orange Bowl going against the Sugar Bowl on two separate channels at the same time? That's how it used to be. Now we have so many bowl games going on, yeah, and the bowl business And that's exactly what it is. It is a business where a lot of these cities, and personally, I've worked with the National Sports Council. I do work now with the Atlanta Sports Council. And it's a business, and it does bring some excitement to the city. And that's where you kind of all these cities realized, hey, if the Fiesta Bowl can have a game, why can't we have a contest? And that's where you have games in Charlotte, and now we have, and it used to be either West Coast or Southeast, and in Texas, Cotton Bowl, gotta respect the Cotton Bowl. Those were the only locations that would have the contest. Now we have games in Detroit, we have games in New York now with the Pinstripe Bowl and Yankee Stadium. Boise, Idaho has the Potato Bowl. All of these cities are putting their toes into it and delving into the bowls. And it is a business. It does make some decent money. It's not going to break the financial bank unless you're one of the heavyweights, which we'll get to in the bowl matchups. But it still brings some excitement and interest to your city. But despite all of that, I see that bowls are a business. My Vanderbilt Commodores, 8-4, third straight year making a bowl game. James Franklin turning the program around. Outstanding job by him, making the Commodores not only respectable, but a solid SEC team. Something I would not think would happen in my generation. They're going to the Compass Bowl in Birmingham. They're playing on January 4th. From Commodore fans, it's weird because you're happy that they're making bowl games, and that you're content with that, but you want something a little bit more. And it's really more for the players and the fans to an extent as well than anybody else. So they finally make a bowl, Music City Bowl, win that. But it's in Nashville. And yes, I said, I work with the Music City Bowl, great people. But, if you're going to a bowl game, you kind of want to go to somewhere different and experience that. Then they get to the Liberty Bowl in Memphis. Okay, that's cool. It's not in Nashville, but you're still in the same state. And now they're going to Birmingham. The past 2 years have been really more of the contention, and particularly the Venom is geared towards the Gator Bowl, the one in Orlando, in Jacksonville. The thing about it is, you look at 2 years ago, it was Mississippi State that ended up getting that Gator Bowl bid. And the reason they didn't want to take Vanderbilt was because they were facing Northwestern, and they didn't want a rematch of that game. Northwestern and Vanderbilt played earlier in that season, so they didn't want a rematch. Okay, well, bowls are a business. You don't want rematches, less interest in seeing two teams match up. Okay, whatever. Now this year, Georgia is in the Gator Bowl, and Vanderbilt beat Georgia during the regular season. And there was, beat them, it was pretty obvious that Vanderbilt was a better team this year than Georgia. But Georgia may have the bigger alumni base, may bring more money to Jacksonville. Okay, once again, you're kind of seeing the politics of it work. But as I said, just as a fan of the team, I just want to see a little bit better, for them. And the excuses of, they wouldn't sell out their bowl allotment. Vanderbilt, the past 2 years, has sold out their bowl allotment of tickets. They've done their job. So that's not a reasoning for it. I guess they want the ancillary extra fans just to go down to the city and enjoy it. But it just shows you that, and we all know that college football and college sports is a business, whether it's big-time business when you get the high-level college football and men's basketball, or even down to the Olympic-style sports at your schools of interest. It is a business. A profit must be made, or at least to stay within making the budget. But I said, I was just disappointed not to see them make a major bowl, or a relatively major bowl. I mean, I'm going to watch the game. I'm going to still try to head down to Birmingham. I'm trying to figure out the plans as far as that goes. It's on a Saturday. I could pull it off. But I just wanted to see them get a better opportunity for the players. I mean, for Jordan Matthews and Austin Carter Samuels and the seniors and guys who've really made an effort to bring more respectability to the Commodores. But I know Franklin's going to have them balling and going for that second straight 9-win season, so they'll do well. But also, you see the bowl game business. You look at Duke, who's going to be in the Chick-fil-A Bowl against Texas A&M. And I said, I don't have any inside sources. I'm really going on what I've read. Interesting to see as far as Duke may have not been the most viable candidate for the Chick-fil-A Bowl. They may have wanted to take a Miami or some other team. And then you hear that the ACC commissioner, John Swofford, really stepped in and made sure that Duke got a quality bowl game for in the Chick-fil-A for winning their the Coastal Division of the ACC, one of them. Understandable that the commissioner does that, wants to protect Duke for winning 10-plus games, winning their division. You want to protect them, give them the best bowl. And that just shows the business of it as well. But it's kind of different from the Chick-fil-A Bowl, who sold out every year for the past few seasons. So their tickets have been sold, so I don't think that's necessarily the issue. But you want to get the ratings up, and Duke may not be as attractive as a team as Miami or maybe a few others. But he protected the product as far as Swofford, so you have to respect the hustle. We'll get to the bowl matchups, especially the BCS games. Auburn, Florida State, not too much argument there. Those two, just the way things worked out, I think are the two best teams right now in football. Ohio State and Clemson, intriguing Orange Bowl. Oklahoma versus Alabama for the Sugar. You can argue maybe want to see Oregon in that spot, so we can finally get that Oregon game against an SEC team. We saw it a few years ago with Auburn winning the national title. But just seeing that offense, Alabama offense against Alabama defense, that would have been intriguing. Michigan State versus Stanford in the Rose Bowl. Sparty's first appearance in the Rose Bowl since 1988. And they ended up winning that game, beating USC. Andre Rison, top player for them back in the day. Really, that was nice to see Michigan State get to a Rose Bowl. I know that for their fan base, that was a big moment to try to finally make it back there. Because I think outside of Minnesota, and Iowa hasn't been in a few decades. Iowa hasn't been in a few decades. A lot of those other teams that finally have made it to Pasadena. We've seen Penn State there, Ohio State. Of course, Wisconsin's been there the past few seasons. So we've seen some Big Ten teams. Northwestern's even been there within the past 20 years. So it's good to see Michigan State have a moment and get to that game, beating Ohio State in the Big Ten championship game. Baylor versus Central Florida. I was going to try to get the nephew on the show. He plays for Central Florida and make an appearance and make a cameo. But really excited to see Central Florida, a team I follow on a weekly basis or everyday basis for family reasons. Really glad to see them in the Fiesta Bowl against Baylor. That's going to be a really good matchup. Two offenses that have potential to put up points. And we'll delve a lot more into that game once we get closer to it. The Mac Brown situation in Texas, we talk about business, and this is the prime example of business 101 in big-time college athletics. We all know Mac Brown's going to leave, whether he steps down, quits, whatever. Texas is going to move on, whether it's to Nick Saban or another head coach. But similar to Shanahan as far as getting your money, you're seeing that in high form today with Mac Brown. He's going to get his finances, but he wants to make sure everything is crossed off. If he quits, he's not going to get all of his money. But if he's fired or steps down or they come up to an amicable agreement, that's really what's holding this up. People are saying, oh, Mac wants to announce to his players individually or address them as a group that he's going to move on. No, this is business. He wants to make sure all of the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted so that when he leaves, he gets his money. And Nick Saban is doing the same thing in Alabama. Sexton, his agent, is doing a great job. Alabama, once again, is offering him to be the highest paid coach in football. Or right up there. I don't know if the Texas rumors are true of 10 years for $10 million a year. If that's the case, then obviously Alabama's deal is not as good. But they have a contract extension, probably giving Saban everything that he could possibly want. He hasn't signed it yet. He's seeing how this Texas thing shakes out. And just wants to make sure that Texas doesn't pull a 180 and say, oh, we want Mac Brown back. And then he's stuck without a job. So I like how he's working. I like his hustle. Personally, I think he's going to stay at Alabama. If he left, that would not shock me. We've seen him leave positions before. But I think he's not. Coaches talk about wanting new challenges and being motivated and all that stuff. He has enough challenges and motivation to keep Alabama at a high level. They just lost to their arch in-state rival and cost himself a chance at a national title. He has motivation enough in his conference. When we look at some of the other, well, Chris Peterson, for example, moving to Washington, which I think is a home run for himself and for the Huskies program, that's where you want to seek a new challenge. You're at Boise State. You've reached the maximum, I think, with that program. You want to go to another school with better resources in a major conference and see where your talents can take you as far as a head coach. That's where you want to step your game up and see what you can do and take that challenge. Saban has the biggest challenge in all of college football, even bigger than if he moved on to Texas. Dealing with not only the fan base, but dealing with the SEC, having to face LSU, Auburn every year. Dealing with Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina, teams that they're going to get, Florida, they're going to get their act right at some point. Dealing with one of those teams, that's where their challenge is going to be, keeping that at a high competitive level. So that's where I think he's going to stay at Alabama. But you never know with him. I mean, he's moved on from Toledo to Michigan State to Miami in the NFL, to LSU, and you know, everywhere in between, even an NFL stint. So he's used to moving around. But I always just think that he has everything that he would need at Alabama as far as finances, structure. He's a dictator there. He has everything he wants. Everything he says goes. So he has control, which is really what he wants. So he has that. No problems there. Financially, he's compensated very well. Even though, you know, if Texas is offering more money, you got to respect that. You got to look at making more money. But overall, I think that's where he's going to end up. But that can change by the time you listen to this podcast at work or at home. And finally, USC, I think, acted a little too early in relation to hiring Steve Sarkisian. I thought when Pat Hayden came there and cleaned up the mess of the Pete Carroll era and the Reggie Bush situation and ended up getting rid of Monty Kiffin, who was a holdover from the Pete Carroll days when he was at USC, I thought they were trying to turn a page and move on to a different era. Hiring Steve Sarkisian, who was an assistant under Pete Carroll, is just going right back to where they started. Sarkisian, I think, has done an okay job at Washington, got him to a few bowl games, but you're kind of delving into the past to try to revive that era that I thought you were trying to move on from. So I thought that was kind of a hasty hire there. They could have held out a little bit longer, but we'll see what happens when he gets over to USC. All right, we're going to take our last break here, and when I come back, I'm going to delve into miscellaneous news and notes in the world of sports. We're going to talk about some baseball and some mixed martial arts here on the podcast. All right, welcome back to the podcast, Dean Marcel Portuit. Baseball winter meetings took place in Orlando this past week. That's outside of Robinson Cano's big signing with the Seattle Mariners, which I delved into quite a bit over on the startinglineup.net. Go over to their podcast or their internet radio show and listen to all my thoughts with that. Not much movement going on with that. Heard the David Price trade rumors. Are a lot of the Jeff Samardzija rumors as well with the Cubs. In the next podcast, I think that's going to be shooken out a little bit more. So we'll dedicate a section to the latest wheelings and dealings in the world of baseball. But I just want to acknowledge that I've been following that, and we'll see what happens there. While I was in Chicago, I also watched the Mark Hunt Antonio Bigfoot Silva fight on UFC on, I guess, Fight Night. I guess what they call the Fox Sports 1 events. Fight of the Year contender, definitely. Two men slugging it out. Personally, I thought Silva had the edge as far as winning the fight, but it ended up being a draw. I completely understand that, though. It's one of those draws you're not mad at. But to see heavyweights and two guys who really don't go deep into their fights, if they fight, it's usually a knockout or for Hunt or a submission or even a knockout for Silva, usually pretty quickly into it. So when I saw that, not only was it going to be a main event, but a five-rounder, I was like, oh, this isn't going to last past two rounds. And sure enough, it went the five full rounds, outstanding fight. Really love seeing the big guys go out in heavyweights. And there was some critique that once it got to the fourth or fifth round that the technique lessened. Of course it's going to lessen. Those are two 250, 60-pound guys slugging it out. And I still thought they had technique. The footwork's not going to be perfect. I mean, both of them aren't exactly the most technical guys. I mean, they're very technical. They're very respectable in there to be an MMA fighter without question. But it's not like they're, you know, just legendary footwork Anderson Silva guys out there just dancing around. The two of them slugged it out, showed some great heart, really good effort from them. This Saturday or tomorrow, we have UFC on Fox 9. Demetrius Johnson faces Joseph Benavidez for the flyweight title. I personally think that we're going to see Demetrius Johnson come out with the win again. They fought a year ago with Johnson getting the victory. I've been really impressed with Johnson the past few fights. His last fight in July against John Moraga in the last UFC on Fox event, that fifth round submission was so beautiful. And we complain, as mixed martial art fans, we want to see guys finish the fight. We want to see him be aggressive. Johnson, I thought, was ahead on the scorecards when that fight got to the fifth round. And still went for that submission and got it. I actually stood up and applauded that. Because I love that he had the fight in the cards, but he still went for it. It was aggressive. That was beautiful, seeing that take place. And I think he's going to get that win against Benavidez, who is an outstanding fighter. He's only lost to champions in his career. He's lost to Johnson. He's lost to Cruz a few times for the title. So he is an outstanding fighter as well. Dominic Cruz, that's who he's lost to twice in his career. So Benavidez is a no-joke major guy as well. But I'm going to go with Johnson to win that fight. All right, let's get to what ruffled my feathers. So as I mentioned several times, I was in Chicago this past week. Really great city. Saw some outstanding museums. Saw the north side, south side. Got to the west side quite a bit. I saw a lot of it. But when you're in Chicago, the one reality you have to deal with is that it's going to be cold. As I mentioned earlier, it didn't reach more than 25 degrees while I was there during the day or at night. It's going to be freezing. It's tough weather, but if you can deal with that, you're okay. Some people that could not deal with the cold weather was the ESPN Monday Night Football pregame crew that was at the game when they beat when the Bears faced the Cowboys. You saw four people there: Susie Colbert, Ray Lewis, Steve Young, and Trent Dilfer on the sidelines before the game. You saw them shivering and complaining about the cold and barely able to talk. Yes, I know that it was, I think the wind chill was below 0 degrees. So it was in the negatives. But you are grown people out there commentating on sports. Stop complaining about the damn weather and do your job. As someone who is trying to grind and fight and claw his way into this industry, seeing some people complain about cold weather was ridiculous. Put on a darn hat, wear some gloves, and move the frick on and do your job. Seeing Ray Lewis, their Mr. Tough Guy, shivering and barely able to talk in the cold weather, man the frick up and do your job. Trent Dilfer and Steve Young complain, oh, it's cold out there, I can't do my job. Do it. Stop complaining about the darn weather. You are professionals making a lot of money, doing a job that a lot of us would do, would sacrifice so much for, and you're complaining about the cold. What about those fans out there that aren't being compensated like you are and had to pay to watch the game? Are they cold and complaining? No, they love the game. They're enjoying it. And then, not to get sexist or be a chauvinist about it, but Susie Colbert was the most G person up there. She made a little bit of a snide comment about it, but she was the most professional out there. You are three former football players, Super Bowl champions, the toughest of the tough in your sport. And you're going to let little Susie Colbert be the toughest one there and be the most professional about working in the elements? That was ridiculous. And also, you're in Chicago. It's cold weather. What do you expect? This is in the middle of December. What do you think it was going to be? 80 degrees and a light breeze like you're in San Diego? No, you're in Chicago. Deal with it. I mean, you always complain about the entitlement of athletes and entitlement of people in a higher positions and whatever workforce that you're in. And you look at that boss person, you're like, man, they aren't appreciative. They look down on you. I felt looked down on as a fan. That was like half the theme of the pregame show. This is why I really don't like watching pregame shows. But I guess I felt nostalgic about being in Chicago. And I said I was going to watch a good amount of the Bears game because I was in that element, in that environment with the fans. I was like, okay, I'm going to watch the Bears. But watching a pregame show and them just shivering and all of that stuff, deal with it. And you're probably saying, oh, Marcel, if you were in that situation, you'd be acting the same way. Heck no. I would be doing my job. I'd be professional. You would not know it was cold out there. As a matter of fact, when I was talking, you would think I'd be in the middle of the beach. Because that's your job. That's what you're paid to do. Be professional about it. And it's sad that it's like, these are football players too. You didn't see the football players complaining, the Bears or the Cowboys. They went out there and did their job. Half of them were in short sleeves. Most of them were in short sleeves, on the Bears side at least. Well, you have a responsibility as a analyst, as a performer, and an entertainer as well, to perform at your highest level despite the obstacles and adversity that you face. And cold weather and being outside is a part of that. Sometimes you'll see me working at high school football games. It's not the best parking. It's not the best amenities. It's tough. I'm working on deadlines. Internally, I may have a little bit of griping about it. But professionally, I will never, ever complain about that job. For two reasons. One, it's what I want to do. And two, I signed up for it. If you don't want to be out there and deal with the elements, don't do the job. Don't sign the paycheck. Don't get your traveling paid for. Don't get all of the amenities. No one is forcing you to do that job. You can walk away from it. And dealing with those realities and the elements of cold weather, that's part of the job. So you signed up for it. You took the money. You take responsibility as a professional and do the job to the best of your ability. And I felt that that wasn't done to me as a viewing fan, a viewing spectator, of that product I saw on ESPN by those three players. Once again, thank you for listening to the show. This is E. Marcel Portu. You can always go to us on Twitter under Sports Inquirer, all one word. Also, send us an email to sportsinquirer@gmail.com. Next show is going to be next Sunday or Monday, or possibly Tuesday. It's going to be early next week. Check my Twitter feed. I always update when the next show is going to be online. And once again, thank you for listening. Until then, good fight, good night, or good morning.